Yeah, that's a good point.
Hey, Jerry. Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Excited. House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, May 6th, 2017.
We're having the information on the state police.
We'll have an informational meeting on the overview of the Oregon State Police. Superintendent Hampton, please. And Captain Fugate, also no? Not here, okay. You're on your own.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Hampton. I have the privilege of serving as a superintendent of Oregon State Police. Chair Barker, I have about 14 slides to illustrate my presentation this morning. It took about 15 to 20 minutes, with your permission. Okay, the first slide just depicts the vision, mission, values of the Department of Oregon State Police. The words on the slide here were refreshed last year from a cross-section of employee input, both the police officers and the professional staff of the agency. With your permission, sir, I'd like to just read those into the record. The vision of the Oregon State Police is to provide premier public safety services. The mission, founded in 1931, the mission of the Oregon State Police is to serve the state of Oregon with a diverse workforce dedicated to the protection of people, property, and natural resources. Our values are honor, loyalty, dedication, compassion, and integrity. I'll spend a little bit of time on our department organizational chart. At the superintendent's office, apologies, Deputy Superintendent Davey, hope to be here today. We regrettably had trooper involved in a serious motor vehicle crash in Coos Bay yesterday, so she's on the South Coast attending to business. With me in the audience is a person that many of you have dealt with or will deal with, our public information officer and our legislative liaison, Captain Bill Fugate. We have six bureaus reporting to the superintendent's office with OSP. Reading them left to right, the Police Service Bureau, led by Major David Anderson, provides the administrative oversight to our sworn enforcement division, patrol, criminal investigations, fish and wildlife, and in addition to forensic services and medical examiner. Within the criminal investigation division, we also have sex offender registration, and Oregon Athletic Commission regulates prize fighting, boxing, mixed martial arts fights around Oregon. Next over is Field Operations Bureau, led by Major Andy Heider. This is the bureau I spent my last 25 years in prior to assuming the position of superintendent in July of last year. These are the police officers that deliver the service, approximately 600 officers statewide within three divisions. This bureau also contains our special operations SWAT mobile response teams. Next over is the Public Safety Services Bureau, led by Major Tom Worthy. Leads our two dispatch centers, our central records, which processes about 750 public records requests a month, our CGIS, law enforcement data systems and ID services, criminal history, our IT and technology services for our department, and as of last week, our school safety tip line is up and running. Our Gaming Employee Services Bureau, led by Major Joel Anderson, is comprised of lottery security, tribal gaming, professional standards, which is our internal affairs, HR, our policy direction, risk management, and training at the Academy. Also a Bureau of Oregon State Police. We're proud to have the Oregon State Fire Marshal, led by Jim Walker, within our organization. And our last is a civilian leader, Administrative Services Director Colin Nealon, leads our fiscal, budget, accounting, payroll, general services, facilities, fleet, and procurement. This next slide is provide the same information, just a little bit different view of the organization. I think the green are the easily recognizable services OSP provides, patrol, criminal, fish, and wildlife. That agency support in that gray section supports both sides, and that blue section is just another way of looking at our sole public safety services that we provide statewide that many people may not be familiar with, especially that bottom half, background checks, firearms unit, ID services, fire marshal, forensics, medical examiner, lottery, tribal gaming, and once again, I want to plug our school safety tip line. If you have one takeaway from this slide, other than the components we perform, it is that on the police service side, OSP routinely holds about 20 to 40 vacancies, a significant number to support not only our police services, but the other, the gray and blue sections of our agency. I'd like to spend a little bit of time discussing some hot law enforcement topics. These are not just for OSP, but spend a little bit of time on staffing, equipment, racial profiling, use of force stats, and budget. This next slide on the topic of staffing and budget depicts OSP patrol staffing when it was removed from a dedicated funding source in 1980. The blue line depicts the population. Oregon's population has increased 52%. The green slide, or the line, is licensed drivers, increased approximately 51%. And the red line depicts OSP staffing. It's decreased over 40%. I mentioned in the prior slide vacancies we hold to pay for the agency. If we were to reflect not just FTEs, but the actual vacancies we hold, that line would look closer to the negative 50%.
Excuse me, Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I, quick question, just a historical question because of this. Maybe, I mean, because, you know, there are people that watch us online and whatnot, and maybe people here in the room. Not going to mention me. Can you briefly, history of that 1980, the dedicated, you know, what was it and what is it now? Just, I think it would be interesting.
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Post. It was my understanding in the 79-81 biennium, OSP was removed. I'm not sure of the political origin or the genesis for that, but we were removed from the state's gas tax, from the highway fund, into competition with the state's general fund. And so over the last 35, 36 years, in good times and in bad, we're obviously in a down budget. OSP has seen the trend line of our staffing decrease. I'll elaborate on where we sit nationally, but we've had a steady decline overall through the last 36 years. This is particularly troubling. OSP, other than our OSU other fund office at the university, does not supply 24-hour coverage anywhere in the state. And in addition to that, we are concerned we are in our third year of double-digit increase, percentage increase in fatal crashes in 2014, 2015, and 2016. Where we sit nationally on troopers per 1,000. This was just refreshed by our patrol division in a manual hand count, physically calling the agencies this past month. Oregon sits second to last nationally on our ratio of troopers per population. If you wanted to look for a good comparable for OSP, draw your attention to Oklahoma, sits at number 15. They have 3.9 million residents to our roughly 4 million residents. They have 820 troopers compared to our 330. If we were to put up a map of
Superintendent,
I'm sorry.
Just really quick, the difference in troopers, I mean, you're talking specifically patrol division?
Yes, sir. These are frontline. I'm sorry, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, these are frontline delivery patrol troopers. This prior graph is patrol troopers and sergeants. I should have pointed that out. Thank you. Thanks. For the question.
Thank you.
And if I was to show up a similar comparison with all the police officers in Oregon, deputy sheriffs, city police officers, and state troopers, we would see that trend that we are close to the bottom compared to our partners nationally also. Quite frankly, if not for the partnerships of our OSP commanders in the field, the leadership of the sheriff's offices and the chiefs of police, we would not be able to provide any semblance of public safety services in Oregon without that level of cooperation, which I'm happy to report that level is very high in Oregon. For those of you on the panel curious to see how your home base has fared over the past 35, 36 years, this depicts the trooper staffing and sergeants in 1980 compared to where we are today. If you're a Willamette Valley office, our larger offices, you can see that we're approximately cut in half on our staffing. Portland area is hit a little bit harder. We're almost at a third. These offices depicted in red are offices that we've closed, vacated the community with a physical office. And this is, just want to emphasize, this is from 1980 to present. These, like in the Portland metropolitan area, this does not reflect offices that we closed in Jansen Beach, Milwaukee, other places that were consolidated or closed prior to this chart. So I don't want to leave here today with the impression that OSP has been cut to the level that we are ineffective. That is far from the case. This slide here depicts the troopers that home garage their vehicles in the red dots. We are fortunate that we don't have enough people, in my opinion, to appropriately staff the agency, but we do have the equipment. We've enjoyed support to appropriately staff our troopers with one-to-one cars. They are equipped with a mobile data terminal. They essentially, they're a self-dispatching center inside their vehicle. They can complete reports, issue citations. Every car is equipped with a video camera, their own weapons. The important point I want to stress is this is not a resource they are sharing with their coworkers. These troopers are patrol ready to respond to an emergency from their home 24 hours a day. And even though we don't have the numbers to patrol 24 hours a day in every community or address every policing action in community, we are fast, we are mobile, and we're efficient. I could shift resources around the state at a phone call or a click of a message across from my MDT, route troopers to Portland at times of civil unrest, to Harney County during the standoff, or a couple weeks ago when we were hit with severe weather statewide. It's really important these troopers aren't sharing a car waiting for their coworker to come in so they could check out a car to go. They're ready to roll during all hours of the day. So if you have a takeaway from this slide, is that we don't have the people we need, but we have leveraged equipment and technology to balance our needs. On the topic of racial profiling, hot topic in the building and in within my profession, both in the state and nationally. Before I elaborate, this is just a quick snapshot of OSP contacts in 2016. We had over 211,000 traffic stops. So the blue depicts the state's population and demographics on a census report. The red depicts our traffic stops on who we're stopping compared to the state's demographics. OSP has collected this traffic stop data for the better part of over 15 years. It was mandated to, when I was younger in my tenure, to collect this data via traffic stop on radio. Now we use our mobile data terminal to collect the race, the gender, the age, the charge, the time of day, who we search, who we don't search, probable cause, what we find. This is a simple snapshot of really in-depth analysis we conduct quarterly with all our command staff, including me personally. We issue an annual report and a biannual report that also reflects our use of force and our traffic stop data, which is also reviewed through the law enforcement contacts committee in cooperation with Portland State University.
Excuse me again.
Superintendent, thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I have a question on the collecting data. Do the officers identify the race of the person they've stopped, or is it self-identified by the person who has stopped?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, this is information that if we don't have it on an official document, some type of state-issued ID, we do use the officer's perception, and we don't ask citizens to identify
themselves.
Thank
you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I do have one other question about that. Are these documentation, that's well spoken. Is this documentation based solely on traffic stops, or is it contacts of people like walking down the street?
Sure. Representative Barker, Representative, to your question, this is all enforcement contacts. The bulk of these are traffic stops, so this could be fish and wildlife trooper or detectives that have contact with a citizen. If there's an enforcement contact, then this data is mandated to be captured. If we have an employee that doesn't have a mobile data terminal, which is almost every police officer we employ, they would be required to supply that data via radio.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you.
I'm interested in that blue line. Is that the whole population of Oregon?
Representative Barker, Representative Greenlee, that is census data that we use for comparison.
It strikes me that the racial distribution, the ethnic distribution of the population you serve might be fairly different than Oregon's total population. You don't serve the cities, basically, I think. Is that right? And the big cities, anyway.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, to your question, we do serve the big city, but we do deal with a transient population. I do stipulate that many of our enforcement contacts are not even Oregon residents. They're people traveling from out of state. And so this has been our best comparable that we have to use.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Just one more point on this. We average over 211,000 enforcement contacts a year, so our data is now in the millions for comparables. So, and it's been very consistent across many, many years of comparison. Our data stayed very consistent on who we're stopping and who we're searching. Once again, don't want to make this into a Ways and Means presentation, but this is just a quick snapshot of the governor's recommended budget. You'll see that OSP is heavily dependent on general fund with a mix dependency on federal funds, other funds, and lottery. This depicts the fund by section and division, and you can see once again that our patrol division is heavily reliant on general fund. And then if we have to balance the books in other parts of the department, we often rely on those patrol vacancies to keep the lights on in the non-traditional OSP sections. These are the approved proposed policy option packages by Governor Brown and the Governor's Rec. Criminal Justice Information Services, POP 100, is a continuation of funding for our LEDS replacement, CrimeView, titled LEDS 2020, hope to be online by September of 2020. This is a multi-year project in the millions of dollars. Every police agency in the state depends on this project, so we're taking it very seriously. The second POP is Forensics 108. Governor's Rec adds 4 DNA biology FTE to our crime labs, specifically to combat the state's backlog of safe kits. Here's a quick snapshot of our proposed legislative concepts from OSP. Patrol Division has House Bill 2323. This would extend exemption of hour limitation to retired troopers working at Revenue, Governor's Residence, and Judicial, similar to those retirees working here in the Capitol. Fish and Wildlife Division, House Bill 2324, suggests an amendment to offensive littering, ORS 164805, to have that option as cited as a violation, not just as a crime. Our Criminal Investigations has House Bill 76. It deals with some amended language in ORS 463, the Oregon Athletic Commission. And Senate Bill 77 and 78 deal with sex offender registration and SORNA compliance. House Bill 2322, State Medical Examiner, assists some language cleanup in the State Medical Examiner statute on their title and titles. I don't know if that was very quick, but I'd be glad to answer any questions, Chair Barker.
Anybody have any questions for Superintendent?
Okay,
thank you very much. That was a good overview for us. Open a public hearing in possible work session on honors and commends the Oregon State Police Fallen Trooper Memorial Dedication Ceremony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative from the Albany area. And HCR 12 comes before you today, and it's something that I greatly appreciate having this opportunity to come before you on. But the idea behind it is that, before I go on and explain a little bit more, I just want to give you a little bit of history of the state police. Oregon State Police became recognized as a state agency on August 1st, 1931. Our first superintendent was Charles P. Prey, and or I should say your first
it's
superintendent. Yeah, okay.
Can I ask him a question?
Excuse me.
Just a second. Representative Greenock.
What was there before that? When I was thinking of that when I saw your slide, too, what was there before 1930?
We had the highway traffic division and also a fish and wildlife division.
Division of what?
Pardon me?
Division of what? The Justice Department? I mean, the Department of Justice?
I do not know that far back. I wasn't alive back then. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick. But I do some research, and I'll get back to you. Okay. Anyways, bottom line on this whole thing is that, to give you this little bit of history here, and I'm going to go quickly here, on October 1st of last year, there was a ceremony that was held, and it was a dedication for the Oregon State Police Fallen Trooper Memorial. Lieutenant Kerry Boyd, who's right back here behind, was a main driver of this over the last few years to get to where it was. Now, it's clearly identifying the 33 members of the Oregon State Police that had given their lives in the line of duty during this time period that I had mentioned. I leave you with this one thought, because I want to kind of describe a little bit of some of the history as we moved forward. If you, some of you will remember, during the 2011 session, we moved House Bill 3039, and what that was an opportunity for us to create House concurrent resolutions on putting road signs out for fallen officers on throughout the state. And it applied to all law enforcement officers. When a few years ago we were preparing to do a sign that's just north of on I-5 near the Chemeketa exit here, Holly Holcomb, who was one of our superintendents, Dick Schuning, who was a lieutenant in the criminal division, and then also Dan Nelson, who had only been with the agency for 5 months at that time and was a recruit, they were all killed in the Salem area. We were putting the sign together for them, but as I was doing the homework on this and the presentation on this in front of everyone a few years back, I found fascinating that Holly Holcomb, who was one of our superintendents that started in 1966, was killed in 1975, just a little bit before Thanksgiving. Matter of fact, he was just shot right out in front of the public service building here. So, you know, I mean, Chair Barker, you remember.
Worked for him.
The point is, what I learned was that he graduated from OSU, became a member of the Oregon State Police, assigned out of the Klamath Falls office. And during that time period, as he served there, World War II started. He had obtained his private flying pilot license and became a member and joined the United States Navy flying airplanes off of aircraft carriers. As I dig into this, I come to find out that while we were entering into taking the island of Iwo Jima during World War II, you have John C. Williams, who is a superintendent, a Marine, years later, a superintendent for us in the state police, and he was a captain when I came on with the state police. But bottom line is, he's down on the beach fighting to take ground there, and overhead flying happens to be Holly Holcomb. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a piece of history and trivia that a lot of people didn't know, but it speaks volumes for the leadership and the men and the women that the state police have. And I don't want to stop and just dismiss just for other agencies. It's for those with the cities and the counties as well. That's the kind of law enforcement folks that we have. So that's where we're at. And what this House concurrent resolution would do is to honor the state police for those who have fallen on our House floor.
Thank you.
Oh, you want me to read?
Okay, no, I'll borrow the keyboard from you.
For the record, my name is Travis Hampton, Superintendent of State Police. Representative Barker, I do have a few slides that illustrate Representative Olson's comments. I'm very much in appreciation for having this opportunity to speak to HCR 12 and the Fallen Trooper Memorial. This memorial does represent the 33 state troopers that have paid the ultimate sacrifice on duty, 32 men, one woman that have died in service to the state of Oregon. This was the vision of retired Superintendent Tim McLean, my predecessor, three superintendents ago for OSP. It was a six-year planning effort using private funds. Fundraising efforts were conducted by not only our department, but Friends of OSP statewide. Representative Olson mentioned briefly, I just want to emphasize this person in the room with us, Lieutenant Kerry Boy, that leads our Central Coast operations. I think it's every chief, sheriff, superintendent's prerogative to have big ideas, but you have to have people that do the work and carry this out. She spent hundreds and hundreds of hours seeing this project to resolution, and I just really want to give credit where credit is due. She has led these efforts, the committee, to commission the work across the street. The dedication ceremony did take place on October 1st, 2016. Governor Brown was in attendance, in addition to many people in the Capitol, including our chair. We had hoped to dedicate the Fallen Trooper Memorial on our department birthday, August 1st. We were a little bit behind schedule, but every subsequent year from this point on, we will have a rededication ceremony on August 1st on our birthday, and you are all invited. Here's a picture of the Fallen Trooper Memorial. as it sits at the public safety building across the street. It was the wish, even though our headquarters moved from the family members, that this memorial would still sit at the state's capitol in the Capitol Mall area as a reminder to people in this building as they come and go to see the sacrifice made by the men and women in our with our department. The fundraising for the memorial is still ongoing. Much like the comment, the column you see depicted here, it is a unfinished life, unfinished memorial, or a life interrupted. We are still raising money for the project. We'll still continue to not use tax dollars. You'll notice that the memorial is in need of who it represents, Oregon State Police. And so we'll supply a kiosk and those letters as time permits, but the commission decided they did not want to delay this process one more day until it was perfect. So it's still a work in progress. And last slide in support is just a quick website if you would like to access and learn more information about the memorial. And this picture is removed from the website. It reflects all the faces of all the troopers that gave their life and service to Oregon. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
And I just would add to what Representative Olson was saying about John C. Williams. He was wounded at Iwo Jima and was actually airlifted off Iwo Jima on his 21st birthday at the end of the battle.
So. Thank you, sir.
Okay, so any questions about the memorial? I want to say it's very, very nice memorial and really appreciate the work the tenants did getting people together to get that done. It's long overdue. I'm glad to have it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 12 be adopted with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson recommends House HCR 12 be approved and sent with a due pass representation. Due pass recommendation before.
I do adopt recommendation.
With a be adopted recommendation.
Okay. It's early in the session.
You're new around here.
Yeah,
but he'll catch
on. Be adopted recommendation. Is there discussion? Thank you. No discussion. Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you. And next we'll open a public hearing and work session on...
I think we need to carry.
Okay. Representative Olson will carry that one. Public hearing work session on the policy.
We're doing the overview.
Okay. Oh, so I'm sorry. We'll start with an informational meeting, an overview of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Skalbis. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known by our acronym DPSST. We're going to follow Superintendent Hampton's lead and give you kind of a DPSST 101. I know some of you have been on this group for a number of years, and this will be a refresher for you, and some of you are brand new and may not even know what we do. So hopefully we'll answer those questions for you. Our mission, to promote excellence in public safety by delivering quality training and developing and upholding professional standards. So it's a great mission, and you probably wonder how we do that. So we're going to walk through a couple of slides and break it down for you. So as we break it down, there's going to be three acronyms that come up throughout this discussion. BPST, the Board on Police Standards and Training. BPSST, the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, and DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And it gets confusing, and we get mail with all three different names on it, and it's okay because we figure it out. So as we go back 56 years ago, police chiefs and sheriffs came to the Oregon legislature as a result of a report written by President Kennedy's Commission on Crime, where they identified that there were no standards for training of law enforcement officers or the licensing of law enforcement officers in the United States. And as a result, the recommendation was that states create a body to deal with this important discussion. In many states, that created what was called P- P- Peace Officer Standards and Training, or POST. In Oregon, we created the Board on Police Standards and Training, which is BPST at the time. And they delivered the first basic police class, which some of you may recall was up at Camp Withicum. That's where we were located for a number of years. Originally, as I mentioned, the scope was very limited to city and county police officer training and certification, and nothing more than that. In 1974, the academy moved from Withicum to Monmouth. We had a great relationship at Western Oregon University for a number of years. And then in 1976, we added corrections to our roster of people that we trained. In 1978, the mission grew in partnership with the legislature, and we added parole and probation as one of our tenants. We also, in 1987, had a financial discussion, which resulted in the creation of criminal fines and assessments, at that time called CFAA. Now it's called CFA. Before CFAA, there was something called a police training account. So citation revenue, traffic tickets went into account, and that provided the dollars for DPSST to operate. And at that time, of course, it was BPST. And in fact, the money was so rich that we even reimbursed cities and counties when they sent officers to the academy for their training time and for their backfill. That's not the case today, but way back, that's what was happening. In 1991, 911 operators, known as telecommunicators, emergency medical dispatchers, were added. In 1993, fire training was added to our mission, as was certification. And at that time, the Oregon State Police came into the standards discussion. Some of you may recall that there were layoffs that resulted in troopers being laid off during that era, and cities and counties were not willing to hire troopers because they weren't BPST certified at the time. So this brought the Oregon State Police into the certification structure for the organization. In 1995, through legislative action, private security was added. The original interest from private security was to professionalize that industry. Their initial estimate was there were going to be about 5,000 private security provider. And checking with our staff, which corrected me from this morning, I thought there were 15,000. There's closer to 20,000 licensed private security providers in the state of Oregon today. In a lot of communities, they're doing things that law enforcement officers used to do, including responding to alarms and things like that. And obviously, post 9/11, there was a very large growth in private security industry. In 2004, the legislature approved the construction of the new academy here in Salem. We're excited for the facility that a lot of you have been to, and I know you'll be coming out later on as while you're here. In 2005, the legislature asked us if we would pick up private investigator licensing. Years ago, there was a group called OBI, the Oregon Board of Investigators. It wasn't sustainable anymore. It was a very small organization, so we folded that in to our private security private investigator program. As I mentioned, in 2006, the new academy was opened here in Salem. In 2011, we marked our 50th year for basic police training. Just a small bit of history that I'll share with you is you just heard Superintendent McLean's name mentioned. Superintendent McLean's dad was in the first basic police class as a Linn County deputy at the time, and Superintendent McLean actually spoke at the graduation for the 50th anniversary with his dad in attendance, so it was pretty neat. In 2013, through House Bill 3194, the Center for Policing Excellence was established at DPSST, and we'll talk about more about that. In 2015, you asked us if we would pick up fiduciary oversight over HIDTA. So we do that. We, in essence, are the bank for HIDTA. The funds come in through the federal government, and the HIDTA board distributes those with our assistance. And then also in 15, OLCC's enforcement agents were added to DPSST as one of the people that we train and certify. Bless you. So how do we operate? Much like the legislature, we have created a structure very similar to what I would say is the ways and means process here. DPSST as an organization serves 41,000 constituents. So police officers, firefighters, law enforcement officers, private security, etc. We have, by statute, five discipline-specific policy committees, and they're the ones that really get into the meat of the discussions that are going to happen. So revocation cases, standards, rules, all have to go through the policy committees, and then they make their recommendation to the full board of public safety standards and training, 24 members, the bulk of which are confirmed by the Senate, and they represent the different constituents groups that we have. So Superintendent of State Police, Portland Police Bureau's chief, chief sheriffs, labor are all represented on the board, and we kind of call it the United Nations of Public Safety. It's a large board, but it works out pretty well, especially with the policy committee structure we have. Policy committees cannot by themselves enact anything. They all have to go to the board for action, and that's the way the statute's created. Six of the members of the Public Safety Board also oversee the Public Safety Memorial Fund Board. The legislature, through legislative action, has created a budget line item for us where we're able to provide benefits to officers, firefighters, corrections officers killed in a line of duty or permanently disabled in a line of duty, and we're very honored to administer that. But for obvious reasons, we hope that that fund never has to be used, but it does. And then at the bottom is DPSST, so that's the department where we basically hand the day-to-day issues of the agency. I'll show you that in the next slide. And then DPSST also administers the Polygraph Advisory Committee, which is created in statute where we license a small group of people, less than 100, that administer polygraph examinations. And then we also staff the Medal of Honor Commission that was established in state statute. So this is how we work on a daily basis. Again, shared stewardship, what the board does. The board has, by legislative action, the authority and the direction to establish standards for training, for employment, for certification, for denial, for revocation, to approve waivers, to give policy to the agency. And basically, it's their way to represent the 41,000 stakeholders that we have. And then the department on a day-to-day function, we staff the committees and the board. We carry out the board's direction. We work with the committees. We provide training at the academy. We provide regional training. We operate the facility. And then we also bring issues forward. So it's kind of a separation of powers that works out pretty well for us. So one of the things that people ask is, who do we have in the standards arena and who do we not have? So for this discussion, we've kind of broken it down into four families. The criminal justice family by far is the where we spend the bulk of our time, and that is city, county, state, and tribal law enforcement officers. So all of the Oregon tribes that have a police agency comply with Senate Bill 412. They're all in compliance with DPSST. We maintain that relationship with them, but they're held to the same standards as every other officer in the state. And within that branch of DPSST, that includes police, corrections, parole and probation, 911, and then, as I mentioned, OLCC. And we'll talk even further about this in the next slide. We also certify fire service professionals, both career and volunteer. There's about 13,000 of them. 80% we know are volunteer firefighters in our state, but approximately 90% of them comply with our voluntary certification system. I mentioned private security, private investigators. Okay, sorry.
Can I just ask a question?
Please.
Do you train them about fire, or do you train them about other things? Do you teach them how to put out fires?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, the functions for our training are very different. So most of you are used to coming out to the academy, and the bulk of our work there is for the criminal justice family. Our fire training program does some training on campus, but most of our fire training is exported off-site. So we have a number of regional coordinators, especially with so many volunteer firefighters, where we take training to the fire stations across the state. So they don't come to the academy like a new hired officer would. We're taking training to their local agencies to help them.
Great, thank you.
Okay. And then private security, private investigators we talked about, and then polygraph examiners also, a very small group that we have standards with. So we'll focus on criminal justice because some of the issues that come up here are how does Oregon line up, and very much with the superintendent's discussion. And you see a lot of things recently in the paper about what some people have called gypsy cops, bad cops leaving one state and going to another. So through legislative action and through the work of our staff with the board, Oregon has created what we call a cradle-to-grave certification system for members of criminal justice. So even though you have left law enforcement, your certification has lapsed, but we still have oversight over your conduct. So if you get arrested for robbing a bank would be an egregious example. The board would take action on your certification, even though you're not currently employed, to make sure you don't go to another state and try to get hired as a law enforcement officer. And that's a discussion that we have ongoing with our policy committees and our boards. And if there are gaps that we identify, we'll always try to plug those so that we basically fix any issues with the system. We also look at training standards. So what does the basic police class look like? What does basic corrections look like? The board handles that. We have maintenance of certification, or the easier way to think of it is continuing education for the different disciplines. We spend a lot of time in revocation and denial. And what we've given you as a handout are two examples of our ethics bulletin. You have the ethics bulletin light version, which was last month, where we only had a few cases. And then we have the heavier version for January, which had a lot more cases in it. And this illustrates the work of our staff and our boards and our policy committees. But we use this as an education tool, not as a punitive tool. So we don't put names in there. We don't put agencies in there because it's to inform the industry that these are the types of behaviors that will get you in trouble and potentially lead to you losing your certification to work in this industry. So we provide that on an ongoing basis. Most agencies use it as part of their roll call training. They'll put it up in their bulletin boards. They'll share it with their staff. But just a reminder about the expectations that Oregonians have about their criminal justice professionals. And then one of the other things that we do that many people don't realize is that we are involved in sheriff's eligibility. So when a person seeks to run for the office of sheriff in a state, they have to apply with our organization, and our staff evaluates their application to ensure that they meet the state statute. And then we notify the county clerk that that name can be posted on the ballot for an election. So those are, you know, it's sometimes super busy and sometimes not. Just depends on how many people want to be a sheriff in a given county. So switching gears, we've talked about standards. Now we'll talk about training. So for criminal justice, a newly hired officer comes to the academy for 16 weeks. So this is a person with no experience hired by a local community. If they're in corrections, they come for 6 weeks for city-county corrections. Parole and probation, it's a typo, it should actually be 5 weeks. And then there's an additional week if they carry a firearm. Not all of our county parole and probation officers are armed. It depends on the jurisdiction. Some arm them all, some don't. Depends on mission. But if they do carry a firearm, they come back. Our 911 training is 3 weeks in length, and then the OLCC program, which is relatively new, is 4 weeks in length. The partnership that we have through criminal fines and assessments, and again, not a discussion of ways and means, but what happens is it's a state-local partnership. So DPSST, through legislative action, criminal fines and assessment pays for the training that we provide for that new officer coming to the academy. So we pick up meals, lodging, training, ammunition, all the different expenses they have, and that the employer that's hired them picks up their salary and benefits while they're with us. One of the other things that I'm also very careful to mention is that this number could be misleading if you don't realize what's beneath the surface, which is that the academy is 16 weeks in length, but it doesn't mean that the men and women crossing the stage at the end of 16 weeks are ready to go. They've completed the academy, then they return to their employing agency and continue their field training with a coach that's been trained there. And in some agencies, that takes between 16 and 18 months before they're ready to go solo. And both of those elements, academy and field training, are required by board standard before they can be certified by the state. For regional training, we do also bolster training across the state through a regional network, and then we do also provide fire training, as I just mentioned. And then for private security, we train managers, and then we set the course. So there's a minimum state training course for a private security provider that's a state minimum but not agency specific. So depending on where they're at, whether they're working at a lumber yard or at Bonneville Power, that local agency will cover the state standard but then provide additional training specific to that assignment. So mentioned Center for Policing Excellence. We're excited about the work being done here. It's a criminal justice reinvestment through 3194. We're embracing evidence-based policing. We've been nationally recognized for our efforts. So we thank the legislature for their support of this. It allows us to provide the 80-hour supervision class, the 80-hour management class for law enforcement leaders. We also provide a 160-hour program on leadership and ethics. And then we're also doing research in this program. Most of the national research in law enforcement is done at communities 100,000 or greater, which is great if you're one of the four cities in Oregon with that kind of population. But how does that help the two- or three-person department in Oregon that doesn't have that same capability? So we're entering this discussion and doing some pretty exciting things with that. Tied into that, mental health crisis intervention. Last legislative session, this body was kind enough to add two positions to DPSST specifically for this discussion. Representative Olson and Senator Boak was brought us in last year and asked if we could help the Oregon Health Authority that had dollars for mental health training but didn't really have a network with public safety. And we're glad to tell you that we're doing some pretty exciting things there in partnership with not only the chiefs and sheriffs but also our public safety and our mental health responders. We're basically creating a statewide framework for how agencies address people in crisis, but then also the training needed for their first responders. In less than 6 months, we provided training to over 600 people. people on dealing with people in crisis. And a lot of you know in the news, you'll read things about crisis intervention teams or what's known as CIT. A lot of times people have thought that's just a metro issue. It's really an issue statewide, as you know, with people in crisis. So the two staff that we have are helping broker crisis intervention teams on a regional basis. And in some cases, it's maybe two or three counties working together because they just don't have enough staff to do it. But it's working out pretty well, and we're excited about that. Also, Center for Policing Excellence, we're dealing a lot with police transparency and legitimacy discussions and getting information out to officers on how that should be administered. And then this is also where our curriculum is developed and designed and redefined. So we're looking at a lot of facilitated learning, and I apologize because today is kind of death by PowerPoint for you. We're moving away from this in our classrooms, really scenario-based hands-on training, which a lot of you have seen. This is a slide that we wanted to share with you, and this is a discussion we've had with those of you that are on Ways and Means last session and on eBoard. And this is something that we're very concerned about, which is the future, and not from a DPSST training, but how many classes can we have offered to meet the need of how many people are going to retire. We were fortunate to receive additional dollars in 2016 to add four police classes and two corrections classes into our schedule, and that was to meet the potential survey of 500 people in law enforcement alone leaving last year, and that number became a reality. We are at a point now where we have an e-board request in to add additional classes between now and June to meet the number of people that are getting hired, and most of the people getting hired to fill retirement vacancies. Our status or our survey has showed that more than 1,000 certified police officers are eligible to retire right now. That number will grow over the next 3 years, so potentially there will be more than 1,000 that are able to retire. So as there's discussion about PERS, every time somebody talks about PERS, there's people saying, I want to have what I have and I'm going to retire. Not that all those will leave, but they're eligible to leave. So we're very careful about how many classes do we have, because the impact of us not having the classes means that those officers, deputies, troopers are sitting somewhere in an untrained capacity waiting to get into a seat at the academy. So we're having that discussion ongoing, and that's what we're looking at in the future. So you see, as we look at 17, 18, the number of officers that we're going to have to train is significant, and it's not that we're afraid of it. We have the brick and mortar. We've got a great facility, great staff, but we need to have enough classes to offer for those men and women that are going to be hired.
So, Eric, just a real quick question on that. As you're that graph right there, I'm hearing that it's happening all over the nation for law enforcement having a difficult time recruiting because of qualifications. Mm-hmm. How are you dealing with that here?
So I think it's a great question, Vice Chair Olson, and I'll give you kind of two different discussions that we're involved in. So the national discussion is it's a tough time to find officers, whether it's police, corrections, probation. If you look at the news every night, who wants to be exposed to that, the social media, and then you have the discussion if your son or daughter comes home and says, you know what, I think I want to be a police officer. I think I want to be a state trooper. Is this the time that you think that would be a great idea for them or not? So that's the one discussion, but I do know what we see locally with the partnerships we have with the chiefs, with the sheriffs, with state police, is that agencies are doubling down. They're doing a lot more recruiting than they have in the past. We're getting to people younger than later. And what I mean by that is a lot of people felt in the past, let's just wait till they're out of high school. Let's wait till they're out of college. We're too late. Kids are making up their minds earlier. So we're seeing not recruiters go into schools, but we're seeing officers be more available, go on ride-alongs with officers. So they're letting kids know today what opportunities they are. Last year in the spring, we hosted our first ever career day at DPSST. And not because we are hiring, but we have applicants now where their moms and dads want to come and see the academy where their son and daughter are going to stay before they decide if they're going to work in an agency. We host state police training at our campus. We've had a mom come a few months ago that wanted to come to the interview with her son. And OSP did a great job and says, ma'am, we are glad that you're here, but we're hiring your son. We're not hiring you. But we'd be glad to hire you if you're interested. So I think we're all working on that together. But the other thing with this demographic is that we're at 5% unemployment. Amazon is struggling to find people. Uber is struggling to find people. We're all fighting for that same applicant. What I will tell you that I'm very proud of in our work is that in a lot of other states, people have suggested that maybe we should lower the standard for what we're looking asking for. We haven't had anyone on our board or anybody in this building say, you know what, we should address this by lowering the standard. In fact, some people will say maybe the standard's not high enough at times. But we're at the right place, and nobody's trying to compromise on who we're looking for. But I think what we're seeing is with the recruiting, we're seeing really good people. But the other thing that I'll share with you is that we also see people that sometimes maybe second-guessing their career. I know when Superintendent Hampton, when their trooper was shot just before Christmas or on Christmas, one of their recruits left the academy, and they said, I didn't sign up for this. This isn't what I want to do. So that reality came home. We see the same thing in our basic classes when we do simulators or scenarios involving children or some other kind of crime that they respond to, where we had a student that left a note on their pillow at night and said, I didn't sign up for this. I can't do this job. I'm going to leave. We're okay with that because that means we're not bringing people into the industry to decide later. But we're working on it, but we're not worried about it. I just think we're doing a lot better at recruiting people and come in on our career day. What I'll share with you, Representative, is that we hosted a Friday-Saturday event. Saturday specifically recruited at targeted at women in law enforcement. We had 49 Oregon agencies that were actively recruiting there. We had over 1,500 people come on Friday and more than 500 women come on Saturday. So all of the recruiters that day on Saturday were women in policing from those different agencies. So they can talk to a peer, and they could talk about what the job is. So we're doing a lot of things different, I think, than we have in the past, and it's working out pretty well.
Thank you.
Thanks. So just wrapping up a few more slides, and I apologize. From the funding, how DPSSC is funded, I mentioned criminal fines and assessments, 911 telephone tax pays for the dispatcher program. The Center for Policing Excellence is criminal fines and assessments, but we also have a criminal justice grant that funds that. And then, as I mentioned, OHA is funding the mental health pieces. Regional training is criminal fines and assessments plus an ODOT grant. Fire insurance premium tax funds our fire training and certification program. So if you have a car, a boat, or a plane with fire insurance, 1% of that comes into DPSST, as well as the state fire marshal and state police arson. Private security investigators are all fee-based, so we charge a license for that. Then administration, debt service, and HIDA, you kind of see the breakdown there. Physical plant, really quick, we're right here in Salem over on 4190 Amsel Highway, 235 acres, 16 buildings, 350,000 square feet, and really the whole campus was designed to go to scenario-based training. So we have a village out back, we have buses, we have a bar, we have different homes, so we can make it as real as we can as opposed to the old academy, and it's not criticizing Monmouth, but when people went through Monmouth, we used to say, well, just pretend you're going to this. Well, no, it's the dorm room. I've been here for the last 10 weeks. I know what it's like. I know what I'm searching for. In the new facility, we make it real, and it's very innovative what we're able to do there. I will always end on this slide, which is honoring our fallen, and I've left you all a flyer inviting you to our state memorial. Through legislative action, there are two memorials created in the state, and obviously Superintendent just talked about the Trooper Memorial. But through legislative action, there's a memorial that honors all of our fallen law enforcement officers at the Academy. Sadly, that memorial includes the names of 183 men and women who gave their life in the line of duty. And then we have another memorial right next to it that honors 168 firefighters, both career and volunteer, that have died in the line of duty, both prominently located in the front of the campus, and we're honored to recognize those men and women for their service, and equally important, recognize the families that they left behind and the coworkers. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's our overview, and I'd be glad to answer questions if people have them.
Yeah, I have a couple. So about how many people annually do you decertify?
So we have had a high of 100. We're probably down into, Lindsay, the 70s?
About 60.
60 now, yeah.
And then one other kind of a connected question. You said, so if somebody has left law enforcement and then they do something and you decertify them, how would you know about that unless it was above the fold on the front page or something? I mean, because there's a lot of former police running around.
So once you're in our system, you're in our system forever. And I don't want to make that sound like Big Brother, but we're tied into LEDs. So your certification number with us ties into LEDs. So if you're arrested somewhere, we'll get a printout in the morning that says that you're lodged at a county jail or that you're some location. So that'll trigger our professional staff to open up a case. We also do get the newspaper clipping. So we go through that when we see things. And then we also have sometimes employees call up and say, so-and-so did this, and we think you should look at it. But the relationship we have with the chiefs and sheriffs is great. You know, they don't want to hide the ball, if you will. They're very forthcoming when things come up. So we're very active in that discussion.
I think, and I just, you know, point out, I read in the Oregon primarily over and over again how about nobody can ever be fired. You know, and unless it's, they make headlines when they get fired, no, the public just doesn't see it, the papers don't report it, but you do a great job in keeping trying to keep that industry, if you will, clean.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Barker. And what I would add is there's kind of a couple of buckets. We look at drug, sex, money. Obviously, that's a big one. Untruthfulness is a big issue for law enforcement providers. But one of the things that we're very transparent with the media is if they want to follow a case, they're more than happy to do that. Our board and policy committees are public, and they're more than welcome to come and sit in on it and see how we hold officers accountable.
Thank you. Any other questions? I want to thank you once again. You invited some of us, invited everybody, but some of us were able to make it here a week or so ago, and I think it was a very valuable training for new people and even for a few refreshers there. So
thank you
for doing that.
Thank you. And I appreciate that you didn't arrest me that day when I was in the scenario.
I knew you could speak English, so. Close the hearing, and we'll open a public hearing work session on House Bill 2294.
Please. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. This is House Bill 2294, brought to us by DPSST. There is the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, which was just mentioned, and the board is required under Oregon law to establish 5 policy committees and specifies who serves on each of those committees. House Bill 2294 adds one person representing the public as a member of the policy committees covering corrections, fire, police, and telecommunications. HB 2294 further specifies that this person must not have been employed or utilized within the area addressed by the policy committee, and that the person may also not be related within the second degree to a person who is employed or utilized within the area addressed by the committee. Finally, for the 5th policy committee, the private security committee, House Bill 2294 changes the eligibility requirements for the member representing the public to match those established for the other policy committees. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Lindsay Hale, please.
Thank you, Chair, Committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I oversee the Professional Standards Division at DPSST. Whitney did a great job kind of giving you an overview of what we're trying to do with this bill, so I'll be very brief and we'll be happy to answer any questions at the end. House Bill 2294 comes to you on behalf of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training. The concept for this bill was developed at the recommendation of a multidisciplined work group that was established with the permission of the board to review and make recommendations for changes as necessary to the standards that currently govern the denial and revocation of criminal justice certifications in Oregon. As mentioned by Director Gablix in his agency overview, the Oregon statute does establish these 5 discipline-specific policy committees, and they're responsible for making recommendations to the board on policy-related items, on training curriculums, and also they make recommendations whether or not certifications should be denied or revoked as a result of an officer's misconduct. The membership for these committees is established in statute, and it represents all different ranks and disciplines that committee oversees. However, with the exception of the Private Security Policy Committee, the general public is not represented on these bodies. Given the gravity of some of the recommendations being made and to increase the transparency and the legitimacy of Oregon's board and policy committee process, the board is requesting through House Bill 2294 to add one voting public member each to the telecommunications, corrections, police, and fire policy committees. Again, this individual cannot be currently or previously employed in a public safety discipline, and they can't be related by blood or marriage to someone who is. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Lindsay, I am trying to, okay, I get that you've identified that there's some minimum qualifications in the private security piece. Where is that for the other 4?
Are you asking
The minimum qualifications that I could refer to?
If you would look at Chair Barker, Representative Olson, if you would look at...
The first one on page 2, at line 2, representing public for the corrections officer.
I'm looking at the legislative concept, so forgive me if my page numbers are a little bit different. But if you read in each section, it would say for corrections, for example, in subsection 3, it says the Corrections Policy Committee consists of, and it goes through all of the different representatives, and subsection G within that section says one person representing the public and then speaks to the requirements or limitations, rather.
Well, okay, I understand. Follow up. I understand that. But I'm just trying to kind of figure out. It's just anybody off the streets. I mean, I don't even have to be age 18. I can have a criminal record.
Yes, sir. Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I apologize. I misunderstood your question. Right now, in statute, the chair of the board has the authority to appoint individuals. So there would be an application process that included a background check, and it would be up to our chair of the board, who's appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
Okay. So just one follow-up question. On the telecommunication piece, I would think that it would be difficult to have somebody selected for that policy committee that does not have any knowledge at all with your PSAPs, your public safety answering points, as well as your secondaries, to be able to kind of even navigate through the understanding of that when it comes to dispatching police, fire, and EMS. That's just not going to play into this at all?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that's an excellent point. I think what the work group, when making this recommendation, was looking for is really just that citizen perspective, particularly when we're talking about denial or revocation decisions, to kind of add that independent third look at the decisions that are being made. So all of these discussions and all of the policy recommendations that come out of these bodies are on a consensus basis or a majority of. So we as staff, our responsibility is making sure that these folks that sit around that table have the information that they need to make an informed decision. So we would take it upon ourselves to make sure that person was up to speed, so to speak, on what they were voting on, and if they had questions to ask. But you raise a valid point, but really what we're looking for is that independent look.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just kind of tagging on what Representative Olson said, I understand a member of the public, and I think that's a good thing. I guess what I'm trying to get at is why I've been thinking about this all day. Why the second part? So the persons, anybody from the public who would, as you said, would be vetted, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Why not the relation? Why add the part about they can't be related to or whatever? It just seems a little like overkill.
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Post, I believe that I can speak for the work group when I say that they really wanted to make sure that it was somebody from the public and it wasn't someone who was coming with a perspective or a jaded perspective of what it means to be law enforcement. They want that independent look. So that language came into play because they didn't want someone who retired from a law enforcement agency to just turn around and come back and then make determinations on whether or not someone's conduct was a violation or something like that. It was really to get at that citizen view.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Stark?
Thank you, Chair Barker. Just in response to that, wouldn't it be just as easy or even easier to have somebody who's jaded against law enforcement and wants to come in because, Brother Billy went to jail or something?
Representative Barker, Representative Stark, possibly, yes. But again, it is a committee function, if you will. So those discussions would happen at that level between all of the members. So I don't believe, given the current structure of the policy committee or the current structure of the board, that there would be decisions that could be slighted one way or the other, if that makes sense. We do have we currently have a public member on our private security policy committee, and we currently have a public member on our board, and their existence on those bodies actually lends itself well to some of the discussions that happen. And I believe the intent is to just further that by adding the public member to the other four policy committees as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2294.
So, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2294 be moved with a due pass recommendation to the House floor.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2294 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered, and I'll carry the bill. Is there any further business to come before the committee today? Thank you, committee. Thank you, people, for watching. We're adjourned. People, for watching. We're adjourned.